Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, October 10th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I'm really excited about this week's guest, but before we join her, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible, who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. Remember, it is always going to be 100% free to download, and that is because of the support of listeners like yourself. If you're interested in supporting the show, you can visit my website, www.carasantamaria.com. You can find archived episodes there. You can shop the Talk Nerdy store, and you can click through the Patreon portal and sign up to support the show that way. All right, guys. I got to thank those of you who made this week's episode possible. Through Patreon, that would be Phil T-Bear, Pedro Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much. All right. This week, I am pleased to have a remote chat, with an incredible writer named Maria Konnikova. She's the author of the new book, The Confidence Game, and her previous book, Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, was a New York Times bestseller, won a bunch of awards. It's been translated into 18 languages. Wow, that's really impressive. She's also written for pretty much every outlet you've ever read: The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times, Slate, Pacific Standard, The Boston Globe, Scientific American, Scientific American Mind, and Wired. Her real focus is the intersection of psychology and literature, which is a very cool specialty. So without any further ado, here she is, Maria Konnikova.
So Maria, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's been years since we've chatted, I feel like, except via the interweb. So I'm excited to be doing a one-on-one. I'm super excited to talk about your new book, but also to talk about all the fun things that you're up to. So your newest book is The Confidence Game, right? That came out in January of this year?
That's right, yes.
And have you been on book tour since then, or are you taking a break right now? Or are you working on other things?
So it's on and off. I feel like I've been on book tour since then, but I have had breaks in between. And I am working on some other stuff. I'm actually revising a proposal for my next book right now. So that's taking a lot of time, and it's very interesting to switch mentally, you know, between the different projects, because obviously con artists are still front and center in my mind. And I'm launching a podcast about them in a few months. So they are definitely something that I'm still thinking about.
Oh, that's so exciting. Have you podcasted? Obviously you've been on people's podcasts, but have you had your own podcast before?
No, never. So this is going to be something new. It's going to be with Slate on the Panoply Network. And it's something that I've never done before. It's a totally different skill set for me. So I'm really excited.
Very cool. Okay. So let's back up a minute and let everybody know you are a science writer. You have two books under your belt now. Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, and The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. Maybe let's back up and talk a little bit about Mastermind, because it's probably been a while since you've discussed that, since you're not touring for that one anymore.
This is true.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about why and how that came to be your first book, and that came to be the first real deep dive that you did as a science writer.
You know, it's a really interesting question, especially given my latest project, and I can talk a little bit more about that, but it was really a matter of luck. I was working on a totally unrelated article for this website, Big Think, about mindfulness. And this was, I mean, we're talking, you know, 2010, 2011. So mindfulness at this stage is not a buzzword. Nobody knows what the hell it is. So I have to try to figure out, you know, how do I explain this concept from cognitive psychology? How do I tell people what mindfulness really is. And I didn't want to go kind of in the kind of the Buddhist spiritual direction, because that's a different sort of mindfulness in many respects than the one that psychologists study. Sure. when they just want to talk about concentration and attention and being present and those types of things. And I couldn't figure out a way to bring it home. And then I guess, you know, it's funny how memory works. Sometimes the oddest thoughts come into your head. So all of a sudden what popped into my mind was this scene from what I now know was A Scandal in Bohemia, one of the earliest Holmes and Watson stories, actually the first one, where was it the first one? I'm not sure. No, it was
not. Know.
It was not the first one. It was definitely not the first one, but it was an early Holmes and Watson story. And Holmes asks Watson how many steps lead up to 221B Baker Street, and Watson doesn't know. And I just had this very vivid memory of having that read to me as a child and mm-hmm. just being mesmerized by the fact that, oh my God, you know, people are supposed to know how many steps lead up to their house. I don't know. Sherlock Holmes is going to be so upset with me. I had a hard time between fiction and reality at the time. So I Googled this because I actually hadn't, I'm not someone who was a Holmes fanatic my whole life. So I read, you know, well, I didn't even read. I had the stories read to me when I was young, and that's it. I'd never revisited them. And so I Googled, luckily, the internet's very good that way. I just said, you know, steps to 221B Baker Street. And there it was. So Scandal in Bohemia, and I reread the story. And first of all, the scene was perfect, because what actually happens is Holmes tells Watson that, you know, that's the difference between the two of them. Watson only sees, Holmes both sees and observes. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the difference between mindlessness and mindfulness, to merely see versus see and observe. But I also just loved the story. I had totally forgotten all of the details. And I started rereading Sherlock Holmes. So I wrote this article and started rereading the Holmes stories. And as I was reading them, it dawned on me that they really explained, they were the perfect example for so many different scenarios, not just mindfulness. And I started taking notes, and before I knew it, I had a series of articles from Sherlock Holmes. And then I decided, you know what, this can be a book, and the rest was history. But really, it was all that silly article I did about mindfulness.
Is that a common experience, do you think, for professional science writers like yourself, where you have different outlets where you write and, you know, you're regularly published, and you start to, when you're trying to decide, okay, is it time to do a book? What kind of book is quintessentially me? What is it that I can write about that others can't, and what can I do really well? And you realize that you already have a body of work that just so kind of cleanly flows into your first document or your first manuscript?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. That sounds like the ideal way for it to happen. And that is kind of how it happened with me. I don't know if it always happens. I know other writers for whom that seems to be the case. Mm-hmm. You know, my fellow science writer, Ed Yong, for instance, we'd be talking for years about him writing a book. And he said, you know, I never want to write a book. And obviously he wrote a bestseller.
Yeah, which is hilarious, because he's probably one of the most prolific science writers most of us know.
Absolutely, absolutely. He's actually three writers in one, if not four. you know, his book, if you think about it, there have been precursors to it in his work for years. And then when I started looking at my own work, I did see, so mindfulness is kind of the guiding theme of Mastermind. Mm-hmm. And I did start seeing that I'd been writing about that for a while. And I'd certainly been thinking about it since college. It had a lot of resonance with the types of things I was studying as an undergrad. And I didn't even really realize that. But when I was a senior, for instance, I took a seminar with Ellen Langer, who was one of the first, if not the first psychologist, who actually studied mindfulness in a laboratory. So it all came full circle.
You know, I love that. I would love to dive deep before we get to the confidence game and kind of take that transition, especially in the political climate that we are in right now, because I have a feeling most of our chat is going to be about that. I love hearing about the experiences that science communicators and scientists have leading up to their successful career. So you're obviously a very successful science writer. It among science communication circles, you're definitely a household name. And I think for a lot of people that just love books, you've kind of taken a lot of people by storm with your writing. And so you mentioned a seminar that you took in college. Did you study journo? Did you study science? What made you find the path to start writing specifically about science?
So I studied fiction writing rather than journalism and psychology.
Oh, great. That's cool.
Yes, and I started out trying to be a fiction writer. Well, that's not entirely true because I didn't have any money. So I tried to write fiction while I did other things. So my first real job was as a copywriter in an ad agency because it has writer in the title. So I thought, ooh, excellent. I am going to be a writer. And it was terrible. I hated it. It was soul-suckingly terrible. And so I don't really quit things. I'm a very persistent person. I like to think of myself as someone who finishes what she started out doing. So I didn't want to quit. So I decided, maybe it's not advertising. Maybe I just don't like this agency. So I went to another agency. The first one I lasted at maybe 8 months. The second one I lasted, I think, a month, maybe two. And I realized, oh no, I just hate copywriting. And then I became a bartender.
Nice. You gotta have some real life experience to be able to write. It's very important.
Absolutely. And studying the science of bacteria on beer glasses, I didn't actually, but wouldn't that be
That would be hilarious.
funny? Now that I think of it, it's a pretty interesting project. Maybe we should get someone on
For sure. We could get Ed on
that. Excellent.
that,
Excellent. And so I tried, bartending and then writing in my off time. But I was always exhausted, so that didn't quite work out either. And then I went through a bunch of jobs. I think I had five or six jobs in my first 2 years out of college, and finally landed as a television producer for Charlie Rose, and that one stuck. And I actually that was my kind of training ground as a journalist because it was a daily show. Well, it still is, except I no longer work there. And there are tons of news segments every single day, and so you constantly have to be thinking of news stories, kind of following up, investigating, figuring out who would be the best people to comment on them, and just putting so many different threads together into something coherent. And at the time, talk about another lucky break, they had signed this huge deal for the Charlie Rose Science series, which was going to be 12 episodes, one full hour, 1 hour each. And it was going to be kind of discussions with scientists chaired by Paul Nurse, the Nobel laureate, and Charlie Rose about different scientific topics. And it had fallen through the cracks. So everyone was really unhappy because it wasn't going anywhere. And so I kind of took a crack at it. And I ended up doing it really well in the sense that it was actually going to get done. I was able to put these things together. And I was learning as I went. I'd never been a producer before, but I was able to put this series together. And that was basically, I mean, you're crafting an hour-long story and trying to figure out how these different scientific voices fit together. And that was really, I think, the start of me saying, huh, maybe I can somehow merge this into my writing, and do because I enjoyed this much more than I enjoy the process of television itself, and I still want it to work in print. And so I quit after almost 3 years, and that was my last office job. And I started writing. And I don't actually, it's funny, I don't actually think of myself as a science writer because I write, and I started out writing about so many things other than science, and I still do.
Sure,
I think
sure.
it's a useful term, but also sort of constricting, because one of the things that I still love to do is kind of bend the boundaries and write about, you know, psychology and culture or literature and psychology, and kind of see what happens when you cross those disciplinary boundaries, which is, I think, something that also came out of my television work. So that's kind of my long path to where I was going.
I love that. I love it when people have an experience, you know, a door opens, they choose to walk through it, even though it's not exactly what they trained for, it's not exactly what they where they thought they would end up, and then they find their passion in those moments, and they go, oh, duh, you have this like enlightening moment where you go, this is what I'm good at. Like, I think this is what I'm supposed to do. And I think you're right. That it's funny because I think of science writer as like the echelon. I'm like, oh, well, you're a science writer. You know, it's like my weird world that is so, you know, siloed. It's, I don't want to say it's siloed because I do think there's a lot of crossover, but you're right. It can, you know, saying it like that could be constrictive, especially if you're talking to an editor, especially if you're talking to the people who are helping get your work published. It's like, no, I can do more than that. But the idea of somebody being able to write science well is very hard. It's a very hard skill to have.
That is very true. And you know, the other thing is, and this goes both ways. So I find that on the one hand, you know, I don't want to be pinned as a science writer. I want the freedom to write about a lot of different things. And I think that's been very helpful, you know, in my books and in a lot of ways, that's been helpful. On the other hand, you know, there is this push both from editors and from, you know, from readers to specialize and to be known for one specific thing. And so I don't know if other writers feel it, but I definitely feel torn in those two directions because, you know, this is how I make my living. I'm going to get paid more if I'm the person to go to when you want someone to write about the latest, you know, social psych or neuroscience study. And if I'm known for that, but on the other hand, I might not be as fulfilled as I would be if I had the freedom to write about whatever I wanted to without thinking about those types of assignments.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it would be an interesting question to ask some of the other folks that I've had on the podcast. You think of like, I just recently had Maya Solovitz on the podcast, who, of course, she's like the addiction expert.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got Maren McKenna, who is like the, you know, antibiotic resistance expert. But they do more than that. But it's true. They're the they're the people that get called on when news outlets want somebody to talk about that. They might get assignments in that realm, which is consistent work, but it may feel constrictive. I struggle with that a little in my TV work, too, because it's like, oh, I'm the nerdy science chick. But I'm like, no, but I can talk about social issues and let's, you know, let's talk about civil justice and those kinds of things. Because, of course, in my view, and I'm not sure if you feel the same way, science is just an entree to everything. It kind of underlies everything.
Absolutely. Well, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to study psychology, and actually why I think psychology and fiction are so related. I mean, it's all about, you know, how the mind works and what makes us who we are. And you know, I think that's the most fascinating question in the world. And it's a question that I'm asking myself even when I'm writing something totally unrelated to psychology or seemingly unrelated. I think, you know, what makes you tick? What motivates you? You know, why are you an interesting story? Why is this an interesting story? And asking those whys, that's the essence of psychology. You know, it's really interesting what you were talking about earlier in terms of realizing, hey, this is something I'm passionate about. This is something I'm good at. Because I did have a realization, like, you know, there are lots of people who write wonderful fiction. And I still want to write fiction, and I still do on the side, though it's not published. So it's not like I've given up on that. But what I realized was there aren't actually that many people with a background in, you know, both fiction, so narrative, and psychology. And this was something, kind of that intersection, shedding that psychological lens, is something that I can add to the discussion that other people might not necessarily have to the same extent.
Which is like, so it almost seems so necessary. Like, how do you really even tell a personal story? Or obviously a good writer can tell a story, but to have the understanding of human behavior and the challenges that we face psychologically and kind of imbue that into a personal story. gosh, the characters become that much more full and that much more real when they're doing the things that people actually do. And we know that based on evidence, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I have to say, I cannot believe that you're talking about your past, and I'm looking on your website while you're telling me, and you're talking about all the work you did on Charlie Rose, and you didn't mention that you've been a guest on Charlie Rose. What a surreal experience that must have been work there behind the scenes, and not even as, you know, a high-level producer. It was like one of your earlier jobs in television, yeah. And now, you know, many, many years later, you're sitting across the desk and you're talking about your new book, The Confidence Game.
That was quite surreal, for sure. I did not get to go on for my first book, so I had to earn it. And I didn't actually think he'd have me on even for book number two, so it came as a huge surprise. And it was really kind of great because a lot of the same people are still there, and all of the old producers came down to say hi to me. So it was,
that's awesome.
You know, it was just this really kind of emotional and wonderful moment to, you know, get to hug all of them and say, hey, I can't believe that I've actually made it on the show. This is going to make me sound ridiculously conceited, but it's funny because I remember thinking at some point when I was working there that, you know, like, wouldn't it be wonderful to do something cool enough that I could be a guest one day?
Well, of course. Of course. And I don't think that's conceited at all. I think that that's probably an experience that a lot of people have when they're producing. I mean, I've produced shows before where I'm working on it and I'm like, this person is so amazing and they make me feel so lazy. I so wish that I had done something this cool in my life. And I think it's a great external kind of form of motivation is to see really incredible people around you who have written incredible things and say, maybe I could do that one day.
You know, I think that's very true. I think you need both because I think you and I are probably similar in that we're both very internally motivated people. I know I am.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
So I, you know, I really drive myself. No one else ever has said, you know, you must do this. And I think you kind of have to, if you're a freelance writer, you have to be driven yourself. Otherwise, you're not going to survive for very long.
How could you? I mean, a freelance lifestyle in and of itself is difficult because you have to force yourself to get out of bed. You have to force yourself to work. But then to do freelance writing, I mean, I'm somewhat lucky in that a lot of my freelance work still has call times and still has other people relying on me to show up and to go. But for writing, I will tell you what, I struggle. This is something I was really excited to have you on, just to kind of pick your brain and hopefully for the listeners too. Almost everybody has some experience in their life where they have to write something, whether it's you know, something for work or an essay to get into college or something for, you know, their school work, but they have to just say, you know, it's due and I'm supposed to do, or I got to write a resume. I got to write a cover letter, whatever is. And I think I'm more like most other people in that writing to me is such a chore. It takes so much effort. I procrastinate until the last possible minute. And so for somebody like yourself who truly enjoys writing, how do you find the balance between the times when it feels like work that you don't want to do and when it's like inspiring and exciting and the words just fly off the page? And also, how do you get to that place? Because I want to be inspired enough to write.
You know what? I wish I knew how to get to that place, because if I had a game plan, then my life would be so much better because I'd always be in that place. I'd be like, okay, this is, you know, let's do my get into that place routine, and we'll be there. And the truth is, you know, I love what I do, and I think that I am ridiculously lucky to be able to do it. And I, you know, it's funny, I wake up almost every day with this dual, like, I'm so excited, this is wonderful, and also this fear, oh no, what's happening to the writing industry? Am I going to be able to do this next year?
Oh,
that's kind of constantly hanging over me, and it's dread causing because I don't want to do anything else, which is wonderful. I mean, I think that's actually a great feeling. You know, you're doing the right thing when you can't imagine what else you would do. And that the very thought that you might have to do something else fills you with dread. That said, I definitely, you know, on balance, I don't even know which one is more common. Those moments of pure inspiration when I'm just going and everything is flowing and everything is wonderful, or the slogging when I sometimes, you know, want to bang my head against the computer, except I don't want to break my computer because that I can't work.
Because it has all your secrets.
Because it has everything on it. It's my superpower. But, you know, and thinking, oh my God, you know, I don't want to be working on this article. And it's very funny because I don't really take story assignments very often. Normally it's my idea. So it's something that theoretically I'm excited about. But practically speaking, I think you always get to a point where, you know, you've done your research and it's just not going well. Mm-hmm. And what I normally do, and this is the most, I think, cliched advice ever because I've heard it so many times, but it definitely works, at least for me, is I switch gears. So I always have a few things going at once, and by a few, I mean like 50 million. So I'm someone who overextends myself perpetually, and I always promise that that's it. You know, once I get out from this avalanche, I'm never doing this to myself again.
Yeah.
And here I am 10 years into my writing career, still saying the same thing and still working the same way. There's something nice about it though. It's very stressful, but I work well with that kind of stress. Mm-hmm. It makes me do everything. It motivates me. I'm very good with deadlines in the sense that when I have no deadlines, sometimes things just don't get done.
But sure.
Deadlines light a fire under me.
I think that's like a human experience too. It's kind of like we do our best work when we can gauge how much effort we have to put in. It's even when I'm at the gym and my trainer is like, okay, I want you to do these kinds of squats. And you're just doing them. You're like, how many of them? Like if I can see the light at the end of the tunnel,
right.
I can deal with it a lot better than if I'm just countlessly going and going. That's a tough thing for everybody to deal with.
Absolutely. So I do switch gears, and that often helps me. And I also actually go for a lot of walks. I love walking. Like walking is one of my favorite things in the world to do. Seriously. Like if someone says like, what do you do on a weekend day? I say, first of all, ha ha. I'm working, but a lot of that work, is, you know, I'm going to take an hour walk. I'm going to take a 2 hour walk and just kind of clear my mind. And you often come back to the computer and the words do flow because your brain has been working on it in various ways. Now, I do have to caution that you can't just do that and assume that your piece is going to get written. I only do that after I've already, you know, researched and interviewed people and I'm stuck usually because that's when your brain starts working. It starts to figure out how to unstick you. And sometimes it's as easy as, you know, I walk out of my office and like go get a glass of water and on the walk back, it hits me. I just need to get away from the screen and get away from the page. And I think human brains are very smart that way. Oftentimes you have the information and you know how to do it on some level, but you just have to do it. And you have to let yourself do it. And it's work, you know, it is hard work, but every time that I want to complain, find myself complaining, I try to remind myself and give myself a pep talk and say, you are very, very lucky. You're not allowed to complain.
And the truth of the matter is, you know, it is hard work. You've been very successful. Your book was on the New York Times bestseller list, wasn't it? Your newest book, which is so exciting.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that
exciting.
Is huge. And as much as I can imagine the kind of fear that you mentioned previously about what's happening to the publishing industry, you know, am I getting paid as much per word as I used to? Are the book advances where they used to be? Are there going to be positions open? People are closing their science desks. People are closing their science imprints. You know, are there as many opportunities? Things like that must, in the back of your mind, more than it just being exciting, like, oh, I'm on the New York Times bestseller list. There must be a moment where you go like, oh, this is going to help. This helps because when I write my next book, I'm that much more established.
Sure. Of course. Of course. And I do realize that it helps. On the other hand, you know, it is a very volatile industry with a short memory. And so you're only as good as the last thing you did. So I know a number of writers who wrote you know, really wonderful things who find it really difficult to sell the next book because the last one didn't sell as well as it should have. And it is, you know, it is ultimately, and I understand, you know, it is an industry. I get that people have to eat, but sometimes there's just the correlation between quality and, you know, quantity sold isn't always there. And you have to wonder, you know, can I sustain it? You know, what happens if my next book doesn't do well? I actually, it was funny, I was interviewing literary agents, and one of the questions I asked was, what are you going to do if my next book flops? Mm-hmm. How are you going to respond? And that wasn't a question they liked to answer very much. Really, most of them avoided it because it's a really, it's a tough question to answer.
It is. I mean, because we like to think that it's always an upward progression, and we like to think that, you know, we're always working toward trading up in life and trading up in life. But the truth of the matter is sometimes there are things that are absolutely beyond our control. There's, you know, a project that you work on and you put your heart and soul into it. And then when it comes out, something changes in the political climate, something changes. There's some sort of terrible event in the news that happens to align in a negative way with the content of your book. And, you know, these things happen to people all the time. My boyfriend, a long time ago when he was working as a writer, developed a show that was like a sort of sarcastic show about a character that was very like Americana, pro-American, and then 9/11 happened. And it was like, everything about the show was inappropriate after that. You know what I mean? Yep. And it's like, what do you do? Yep. Those kinds of things do happen to people. You're lucky when the stars align in the right way for the work that you're doing. But sometimes we're all very unlucky too, and we have to be prepared for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can't forget just how much of it is luck. I mean, I got so lucky with my first book because everyone, it's so funny. I got criticized. People are like, oh, she's jumping on the Sherlock Holmes bandwagon. No, I wasn't. Sherlock Holmes was not a thing when I sold it. People forget what the lag time is between you know, the proposal and selling the book and when the book comes out. But I lucked out that just as my book was coming out, kind of in the month leading up to it, there was this huge Sherlock Holmes renaissance. Sherlock came out, Elementary came out, like the Sherlock Holmes movies. All of this stuff happened, and all of a sudden you get this renewed interest in Sherlock Holmes, and my book caught that wave. That had nothing to do with me. You know, that was just sheer luck. What would have happened had that not been the case? Who knows? The book might have flopped. I might have not been able to sell book number two. My career would have been very different. And I certainly did not create the Sherlock Holmes way.
It's all because of your first book that people got. Benedict Cumberbatch read it and was like, I need to be on a TV show.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly what happened. Someone must have given him a galley.
I think so. I think that is what happened. I love this. Okay. I love hearing people's personal stories. I love getting some of the behind the scenes information about how things work. So again, I promise we're going to spend some time jumping into the content of The Confidence Game, but I want to talk a little about the logistics around it. So this book,
sure.
I have a galley copy, actually. I always feel so lucky. I have all these wonderful galley copies from all of my author friends. It says January 2016 publication on sale January 12th, 2016. I'm not sure if that date held, but so it's been, okay, cool. Yeah. So it's been out for a little bit, still new this year, but been out for a little bit. You've been able to do some amazing press around it. You were on Charlie Rose, you were on Bill Maher. You've obviously done a lot of radio interviews and things like that. This book was published in January. When did you first submit? For people who don't know, you usually write up a big, long proposal, and that's even after you've been working on the book for a while. When did you first submit that proposal? Do you remember?
Oh, God. You know, I actually don't remember, but if you bear with me, I can very easily look it up because, you know, what I have is emails for when I was working on
first
the proposal.
First working on it. Interesting. Yeah, because I think, like you mentioned, the lag time when you were talking about Mastermind, I mean, first you come up with an idea, which can take years. Once you have a relatively solid idea, you work with your agent or sometimes on your own to do this proposal, which is a lot of work. It's chapter summaries. It's, you know, reading into the market and how do I think it's going to sell and how many pages do I think it's going to be and what do I bring to the table? And, you know, the proposal itself can be many, many pages long and it's basically the worst kind of writing because you have to sell sell yourself. Yeah. Nobody likes to write their own bio.
So I am looking right now. I actually ended up going a different route and looking at the Word documents to see when it was modified. Mm-hmm. So we are talking about summer 2013. So 3 years.
Summer 2013 until January 2013. So 2.5 years from the time you had a solid concept that was tangible and on paper.
That was actually the proposal. So I, at that point, had already been spending a lot of time. I'd already met some con artists because I think some people think that you just kind of write a proposal, but to write a good proposal, you actually have to do a lot of research. Just like to do a good pitch for a long story, mm-hmm. you have to research a lot of the story ahead of time. And it's funny because when I first realized that, I was like, well, that's not really fair. Like, I don't even know if they're going to take the story.
Yeah, nobody's paid you for this yet.
Exactly. But on the other hand, that's such a good test because if you care about it enough to spend months of your life on it, not knowing whether anyone's going to pay you for it, that means it's a good story. That means that it's one that you can live with for a long time.
And you have to, books, obviously.
You have to. Exactly. You have to be passionate enough about it that you think, you know what, like, I'm just going to do this and I'm going to spend the next however many months working on this. And let's hope that if I'm passionate enough, that will show through and we'll be able to do something with it.
Yeah, and when it comes to nonfiction, like you said, there's real reporting that has to go into writing a book. You don't just dream up an idea and then like search about it on Google and write about it. You have to go meet these people. You have to uncover their stories. And so the confidence game, why we fall for it every time, it's sort of in the title there. This is a nonfiction kind of deep dive into really successful and really suave con artists and how they take advantage of us.
Mm, absolutely. And I, you know, one of the things that I really wanted to explore, and this is also in the title, is, you know, these people are really good, but so are their victims in the sense that their victims are really smart. Mm. I meant that quite literally, people like me. It's not someone else. It's not kind of the gullible person or the stupid person or the person, you know, who believes everything you tell him and is greedy, mm-hmm. Someone who wants money. It's none of these things. And so I wanted to explore, you know, first of all, what makes these con artists so good? And secondly, what is it about us that makes us susceptible to that? And I think the answers overlap because good con artists know what makes us susceptible, and that's what they take advantage of. That's what makes them good. So I spent over 3 years kind of unraveling this stuff and meeting a lot of very unsavory characters. Sometimes their story ends up being, you know, very funny seeming on the page, but something that I had to keep reminding myself was that, you know, these are very charming, charismatic people. They're not good people. They take advantage and they leave victims in their wake. You know, they really ruin lives. That's something that's sometimes really hard to remember just because they're so fascinating.
Yeah. You know, in the summary of the book, there are some really big names mentioned when talking about cheats and swindlers and charlatans and the really big ones that we know about. Who of kind of the household name con artists, did you have a chance to sit down or to even get on a call with any of the really big names and sort of pick their brains, or were they sort of out of touch?
You know, I actually made a conscious decision not to focus on stories that people knew a lot about, but rather to try to report as much as I could that wasn't easily available. So the only one who I think people would know that I had a chance to talk to at all was Frank Abagnale, who's the Catch Me If You Can guy, who now works for the FBI. So he switched sides.
That's so cool.
But that's it. So, you know, I did not speak to Bernie Madoff. Instead, I spoke to other Ponzi schemers. Mm. I didn't speak to Lance Armstrong, but I did speak to a few other people who did doping types of things. Well, not even doping types, who doped.
Yeah.
So who got away with it
for quite a while before they were
busted.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so I tried to make it as much new material as I could. And I actually uncovered some old ones that weren't very well known or that were known but not completely. So it's a mix of current and past. And I did my best to make it clear that it's a very wide variety of people who fall under the con artist umbrella. So, for instance, there are people who aren't motivated at all by money, who don't make a lot of money from these cons at all. There are women. So a lot of the con artists I write about, and this is false equal opportunity because this is something where, you know, I don't want equal representation.
Yeah.
The other people to be the bad guys. But, but I made sure to include a lot of women because women are con artists too, even though a lot of the famous ones are men. So I did do my best to try to look more globally at what this really meant.
I love that. And I think it's a genius approach because the truth of the matter is you can walk into Barnes & Noble and you can buy 10 books about Bernie Madoff and you can buy 20 books about Lance Armstrong. Those stories really have been beaten to death. But when you're trying to learn and trying to, you know, both I think from a purely kind of voyeuristic standpoint, but also from a self-educating standpoint, when you're interested in this kind of behavior and these people where it blows your mind, how could somebody do this? How could they get away with it? You're also in a way learning how to protect yourself from it and how to think about your own patterns of thinking, your own psychological shortcomings, and getting caught up in these webs. So to learn more about some of the little known people is kind of to learn about some of the people whose paths you might cross in life.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there definitely, I mean, I'd be lying if I said that there wasn't a little bit of a self-serving motive in this. I think there is with almost all writing. If it interests you, it interests you for a reason. And that reason is often, you know, how can this help me? Or what can I get out of this? Which is, I think, perfectly understandable. But I definitely wanted to figure out, you know, how do I avoid something like this? And it's funny because in the book, I write this thing, you know, I don't know if I've ever been conned. And I really believed that was true at the time. And then at some point, and then people kept asking me, you know, in all these interviews, have you ever been conned? You know, is that why you wrote the book? And I'd be like, no, you know, that wasn't the motivation at all. And so I kept rejecting this. And at some point it hit me that I actually had been conned because I had dated and moved in with a psychopath. And I blocked that out of my mind.
Like we tend to do.
At some point I was thinking about it and I thought, oh my God. Like that was the ultimate con. I cannot believe I did not identify this as a con when I was writing a book, when I was writing about the fact that some of these people are psychopaths.
Yeah,
and
it's true. Because
about all these techniques. Yeah.
We think about individuals who take advantage of a large quantity of people and take their money. When we think about con artists, we're like, okay, charlatans are trying to sell me snake oil or they're trying to convince me to pay for something that's not of value. And they do it to mm-hmm. lots of other people. But there are con artists who do one-on-one cons. They yep. integrate into your life to like leech off of you or they convince you they're somebody they're not.
Yes, and this is exactly what happened. And I somehow just didn't think it was germane.
That is great. So that never made it into the book.
No, it didn't. And not because I was trying to hide it so much as I just honestly did not think of it until you know, months after the book came out.
Isn't that funny that that the experience, because it must be a totally different experience for you when you are in the process of doing your research, when you're in the process of writing and editing and really preparing a manuscript, and then when you're in that kind of part of the process where you're out at bookstores reading excerpts, signing mm-hmm. copies, doing radio interviews, doing TV interviews. I mean, that must be night and day.
It really is. It really is. And in some ways, you know, you don't have, you know, your brain doesn't have the space to take a step back and kind of gain any personal perspective while you're still writing, you know, while you're in that nitty gritty. I actually think that we should have, by we, I mean writers, should have, you know, like a 6-month clause built into your contract where you finish the book and you turn it in and then you're not allowed to touch it or look at it for 6 months. You can just do other stuff. And then it comes back to you. And then you'll be able to see some of these big picture things that you weren't able to see before. Unfortunately, that's not how publishing works.
So you come to these big kind of insightful moments while you're on the road. You know?
Exactly.
The book's already published. It's printed. People have it in their hands. And you're like, oh, yeah.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's when it hits. You're like, oh, I should have written this and I should have written that. And, oh, actually, we should really update this.
Well, and that's so true, right? That the perfect is the enemy of the good. That, absolutely. You know, you can chase for ages. And I think that's why editors are necessary, because they're like, no, it's done. It's good. Like, deal with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That must be tough. So, you know, we're talking about this idea of con men and con women, what their motivation is, but also why they're so, I don't know, smooth, what it is about their personalities that makes them so effective and why we trust them and how they're good at gaining our trust. And I can't help but think about the political climate that we're in right now, you know, after the debates. So two things. One, I work on another podcast called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This book is so up my alley because, you know, the whole thing is working to be a better skeptic, working to understand our own biases and to go through life questioning things the right way and looking at evidence. Obviously, it's about trying to bust myths and bust charlatans, especially when it comes to woo and anti-science. So, like, hello, right up our alley. But secondly, we try to keep things relatively apolitical on the show. This new episode that comes out, I did survey the sciencedebate.org and Scientific American publication of all of the candidates and their answers to 20 science questions. And my own personal politics, I tried to keep out of it. Anybody who listens to Talk Nerdy knows my politics, but people who listen to SGU, maybe they don't. But across the board, it was just blatantly obvious how much more thoughtful and nuanced Hillary Clinton's answers were and how many of Donald Trump's answers got a score of a 0 or a 1. He never scored higher than a 1 out of 5.
No.
Yeah, it was really
bad.
I find
that impossible to believe.
It was so bad. And many of them were not well thought out, or they were blatantly fly in the face of actual evidence. And then Tuesday, or maybe it was Monday, after the debates, Frontline drops their documentary, The Choice, which follows all of the sort of life experiences that led up to Trump and Clinton being where they are today. And you watch it and you just take a step back. This is, you know, this is a documentary. It's a relatively independent expose. And you take a step back and you go, holy shit, this man is a con artist. You know, he just figured out how to take advantage his whole life and make money off of the backs of others, never made a dime off of any of his companies for anybody but himself, declared bankruptcy, sells his name like the way a celebrity would, but not a businessman, a con artist. So it makes me wonder, you know, you've obviously had to go onto interviews and answer that very question. If anybody is sort of qualified. Obviously, you're not a Trump biographer, so I don't expect you to know all of the ins and outs of his life, but qualified to say somebody's a con artist or not, how do you feel approaching that question?
I used to feel much more circumspect about it. So I was very careful to say, you know, we can't get into his head. We don't know what he's thinking. So he exhibits characteristics of a con artist, but ultimately maybe he's sincere. As the election has gone on, I begin to think that I'm more in the right if I just flat out call him a con artist.
Yeah.
Because we now have pretty good evidence of the lack of sincerity and just the blatant falsification that that he engages in. And it's funny, the first thing that I would do when trying to figure out, you know, is someone a con artist, is look at what are some of the, you know, characteristics that often are the hallmarks of con artists. And you have both personality things, but also what they say and how they say it. Mm-hmm. And you see that con artists, you know, their hallmark is telling you not what is actually the truth, but what you want to hear. So they figure out people's vulnerabilities. The first step of a con is the put up, where the con artist profiles the potential victim and figures out, okay, you know, what are you scared of? What do you want? You know, what motivates you? What are the buttons that I can push? What are your vulnerabilities so that I can play to them? And then they do that. They craft a story that really just perfectly dovetails with those areas of weakness. And they don't do it in a logical way. They do it very emotionally. It's always an emotional appeal so that you don't ask questions, because emotional appeals are much more difficult to question than anything else. And now if you look at how Donald Trump talks to his supporters, well, that's exactly what he does. You know, he tells everyone something different, but it's always what that person, that audience wants to hear. And he never says anything specific. He just talks in these very emotional, visceral generalities. And that's the level on which people respond to him. And the fact that you can't talk to Trump supporters, you can't present any evidence to them that dissuades them, that to me is another red flag that he's a con artist, because the victims of con artists refuse to believe they've been conned while the con is ongoing. That's part of it. You know, they are so in this that it's threatening to them to acknowledge that, you know, hey, maybe I'm being conned. Maybe this isn't what I think it is. Instead, the kind of self-preservation instinct is to rationalize and to get very mad when people attack. And I think that, once again, that's exactly what you see happening with supporters of Trump. You can just put logical argument after logical argument, number after number in front of them, and they're going to tell you to go away. That you don't know what you're talking about, that Trump is actually very honest and crooked Hillary.
Yeah.
Just such a brilliant phrasing on his part. I have to hand it to him because it sticks. You know, people are like, well, crooked Hillary is the really crooked one. Mm-hmm. So all of those things to me just smack of huge, huge con. Someone who is basically selling snake oil. And on the other hand, you see these kind of this bombastic narcissism and all of these kind of characteristics that a lot of con artists do possess. It was very, very funny. I couldn't figure out at first what was going on. At some point, I started getting queries, would I be willing to talk about Donald Trump and narcissism? And I thought, that's interesting. You know, I've never really... Why would someone come to me? Donald Trump, con artists I get, but Donald Trump, narcissism. Then I did a Google search, and the first hit was from my article that I wrote, I think, 5 years ago, something like that, which was a totally tongue-in-cheek article that I forgot about, which went through the DSM-4, because it was still DSM-4 at the time.
Yeah.
Revisions, and put the characteristics of narcissistic personality disorder and selected Trump quotes to fit each one.
That is hilarious.
And this was obviously way before the elections, way before we knew he'd be running for president. And so I thought, if in 2010 or whenever I wrote it, I thought that Trump might be exhibiting narcissistic personality disorder long before any of this went down. That makes me a little bit more confident in my assessment. And then, of course, you have like outright frauds like Trump University.
Yeah, where you can point to that and just say without question, well, this was a con.
Well, right, especially if he is ever convicted, which right now he hasn't been, so we still can't do it. You say it's most likely a con. You have to be so careful with these sorts of things, especially around Donald Trump. I mean, he sues everyone left and right just because that's kind of...
That's sort of his MO, is kind of figure out what's coming at him and pounce on it, double it down. You know, it's like when it just blows my mind, and it's effective when Hillary Clinton says something that could be even, or I shouldn't say that, when he does or says something that the media construes as overtly bigoted or racist, and that becomes the narrative, he'll somehow figure out how to charge her with racism or bigotry. And it's like this weird twist where anytime there is there's a concern about his behavior that we can very easily label. He's very good at changing the narrative and just like elastic throwing it back at his opponent and being like, absolutely. No, she's actually the one, like she's the birther. She's the one who started the birther controversy with Obama. And everybody's like, oh, really? It's like, no, you didn't. That's objectively wrong. Yet somehow it's like, he convinces you that he believes it himself.
Yep. Yep, absolutely.
And I guess a good con artist, that's a big part of it, is whether, you know, we talk about this a lot on Skeptics Guide. There is a difference between, let's say, an alternative medicine practitioner or a psychic, for example, who truly believe that their alternative medicine heals or that they have a gift versus a practitioner or a skeptic or a psychic who absolutely know that what they're selling is snake oil and they don't care because they want to turn a profit. I do think there's a difference in motivation, but the outcome ultimately is the same. And sometimes the people who actually believe their own nonsense are the most dangerous.
Yeah. And I do completely agree with you that the motivation in some sense does matter. Mm-hmm. And that's what I, you know, that's the line between, are you a con artist or not? You know, do you believe what you're selling?
Yeah. Yeah.
And on what level do you believe it? Like, do you genuinely believe it? Do you genuinely think that by selling your snake oil or by being a psychic, you're making the world a better place?
Or when you do it for long enough, you start to believe it. There's also that weird in between.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And on the other hand, you're absolutely right that it doesn't make it any less dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have to figure out, you know, how can you separate the two things so that you can agree, okay, this isn't necessarily a terrible person, but they're doing a terrible thing and it's still a terrible thing.
Yeah.
So you still have to make sure that that terrible thing doesn't happen. Now with psychics, I actually think the ones who truly believe it are often not quite as bad because they don't end up committing fraud on as high a level.
Yeah, that's probably true.
They don't actually think, oh, you know, for 10,000, I can lift the curse off of you. Like that's not what they do for the most part.
It may not have as bad of a criminal outcome, but I wonder sometimes if it's more pernicious because it's harder to fight against, you know?
Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, I think psychics are just very dangerous. It's a dangerous business. And a lot of people are very vulnerable to it. And a lot of psychics are frauds who just hit people at their absolute lowest level. Yeah. That's one of the things that's kind of unforgivable about so many con artists is they hit you when you're down, you know, when your defenses are down, when so many things are going wrong. That's when you're the most vulnerable. That's the one thing that can predispose anyone to be a victim is when, you know, when shit hits the fan, when stuff is not going right in your life. And that happens to everyone. You know, unless I don't know anyone who's lived a totally charmed life. Maybe some people come close, but normally, you know, you have low points.
It's true. And especially with, I think, the alternative medicine practitioners, the people who really do sell snake oil, taking advantage of people when they're in the throes of cancer and they're doing last ditch effort kind of things where they just spend all their money and oftentimes put themselves through situations that cause more health problems. You know, we see them all the time with like stem cell infusions. I mean, just horrifically dangerous things where they have to travel to other countries. That's
terrible.
You're right. It's beyond the pale. Like it would be one thing. We kind of wish that most cons would be these clean things where it's like, well, I'm just going to prey on the guilty and it's going to be a Robin Hood situation. And I'm just going to swindle rich people. Like, you know, in a perfect world, that would be what was happening. And we almost would kind of like not assign as much negativity to it. But when we definitely see the weakest among us being taken advantage of by just the dirtiest people, like how can you not feel terrible about that?
No, it really does. It really does make you question humanity. Mm-hmm. After spending enough time with people like that, I was not a believer in the human race.
You must have needed to take a long shower after doing the research for this book.
It's awful. You know, it's kind of, you're dealing with these very suave people who are also kind of the dregs of humanity on some level, because they do take advantage of people in their weakness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's very funny because, well, it's not funny, it's very sad, but because you have an audience of skeptics. I had the one time that I gave a talk where audience members got really mad was a skeptics audience, because I told them that all of them could fall for con artists.
Which
and
is,
they said, no, we're skeptics.
Which is annoying that they would be mad about that, because it's like, that's rule number one in skepticism, is like to always work to fight against your biases that you know you have.
Exactly. No, that's, see, that's perfect. But they did not see it that way. They fought me on it. They're like, no, well, I would never fall for this. I was like, okay, you would never fall for a psychic, for instance. But, you know, at an emotionally vulnerable moment, there's something you want to believe in, and you're not going to question it if it comes from the right person in the right way. Mm-hmm. I mean, some cons, it's not like it's someone you don't know. Sometimes con artists spend years grooming their victims for truly long cons. And I truly believe, I don't believe that every single person can fall for every single con, but I truly believe that every single person can fall for a con, that there's a con out there for everyone.
Well, because we all have our blind spots. We all have our sacred cows. We have the things that we're especially vulnerable in, the things that we're especially sensitive about. And everyone has a weakness. And, you know, good con artists can find your buttons and then push them. Push them when it's the worst possible time. And also, I think the money cons, many of us can fall victim to simply because of ignorance of what the financial practices around them are. I mean, people fall victim to what I would consider, you probably can't say this on air, but like gross con behavior by like non-fiduciary financial investors all the time. Like certain municipal funds that have insane fees where people are making money off of your money and teach, you know, predatory practices with investments, even with loan. That, to me, that's a con for sure. And it's just systemic, so we don't think of it as being a con.
Well, there's a quote in my book from David Moore, who wrote The Long Con. The Big Con, which is a really wonderful book. And it's about, he was a linguist, so it's about kind of the language of the street. And he says that, you know, before we blame con artists, we would do well to remember that it, you know, they are just one small step removed from people in professions that we find much more, you know, legitimate. And some, even the pillars of society. So there are definitely parallels. And you also, you know, you also end up finding that within a lot of professions, there are con artists. Mm-hmm. Some professions are just all con artists, but within some, you know, you can find con artists almost anywhere.
Yeah, the idea of legitimacy is really just a combination of legality and morality. And I think that that's different for different people. For example, when we look at Donald Trump's business history, there are many steps along the way where what he did may have technically been legal because he found some sort of loophole, but I would absolutely call it a con because it was in no way, I mean, absolutely morally bankrupt and not in service to the shareholders, not in service to the investors, only in service to the bottom line of his personal salary. And, you know, those are the kinds of questions that get murky, but that's where I guess individuals can make their own determinations. I do highly recommend that everybody check out that documentary. I think it was called The Choice. You can look it up on Frontline.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a PBS doc, which means it's free to watch. You can watch it online anytime or on your, you know, Apple TV or whatever. Just it really opened my eyes to a lot. And it went into a lot of Hillary's scandals and a lot of the history of how both of them got to where they are, but I did not know some of the things that I now know about Donald Trump's grooming and upbringing that honestly make me feel that much worse about this election. So definitely, I think it's an important thing to educate ourselves. That said, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, Maria. I could honestly talk to you all day because this is a fascinating conversation. I always end my podcast by asking my guests the same two questions, and I would love to get your responses if you're up for it.
Well, ask away.
And all right. We'll yeah, exactly. They're kind of big questions, so I apologize in advance. So the questions are really about the future, and I'm interested in your take, and you can talk about, you know, a very personal take on it, or you can talk about a big kind of global big picture take, but really they're two sides of the same coin. And that's when you look to the future, number one, what is the thing that really concerns you, keeps you up the most at night? You know, you find yourself worried about, and on the flip side of that, what do you actually have optimism for? What are you hopeful for when you look to the future? I know, I'm evil, I'm sorry.
Donald Trump.
Yeah, right. I'm with you, that's girl.
No, you know, it's the easy answer, but I'm really petrified right now. This is a short term. I'll give you a more long term fear. But I'm petrified. It's not just Trump. It's this rise all over the world of this extremist fundamentalism. I mean, we're seeing, you know, you see these movements in France. You're seeing it. In England, I mean, Brexit really scared me. You know, there's really this climate that is very scary. And I truly hope that we will, as a civilization, get over it rather than succumb to it. Because if we do succumb to it, I mean, we might be looking at World War III. But a little bit less apocalyptically and more along, you know, this is also apocalyptic, but as someone who does deal a lot with science, you know, there are lots of things that really concern me from that perspective. You know, the biggest, I'm totally cheating because I'm giving you like 50 million things.
Oh no, I prefer it. I love it.
But you know, I'm obviously incredibly concerned about global warming and the fact that we're on this spiral to nowhere and that we don't seem to be taking it seriously enough. I'm concerned, you know, you had Maren McKenna on. I'm concerned about the antibiotic apocalypse. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go to a pre-antibiotic era. I'm concerned that people are spending, you know, too much time in technology. And I'm actually really scared at how much we trust technology and how I'm totally not a Luddite or anti-technology, but I think that technological advances are, and this comes from dealing with so many con artists, they're advancing too quickly for us to be able to protect against the hackers who can take advantage of them.
Yeah, it's like they're, we trust them without knowing how they work, which is problematic.
Exactly. So I'm very scared about that. And as more and more things become automated, I mean, as soon as it goes online, it's hackable. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of bad actors out there. And I don't think we're adequately prepared for that. But we want to trust it because it's so convenient. So we're giving a lot up, you know, in terms of our privacy, in terms of our safety, in terms of just, you know, our future. I think we're giving a lot up for convenience. And we have been doing that for a very, very long time. I mean, humans are quite lazy, I think, in many respects. And we like taking the easy and the convenient way out. But these are some of the questions that I worry about and that I really hope to see us deal with. You know, if we don't deal with global warming, we probably won't have to deal with any of the other stuff. But
that's true. There is an umbrella. You know, there is kind of a hierarchy there for sure.
But the technology stuff, who knows? That might lead to really nasty stuff before we destroy our planet through global warming.
Yeah, so. You know, I had an author named Phil Torres on the show who talked a lot about end of world eschatologies, like end of world and apocalyptic thinking. And technology is a big concern of his too. You know, this idea of AI gone amok. Like, it's just something that we can't not think about. We have to factor it in when we're coming up with our contingencies and our regulations. But Maria, there must be something you're excited about.
No, I've got nothing for that one.
That's amazing.
I do think that humans are remarkably resilient and resourceful. And I am very excited about kind of the future possibilities of the human brain and the human mind to just to figure everything out and to make the world, you know, to make the world 100 years from now, make people like me look stupid, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. And I really, you know, I do have this underlying optimism that we'll figure out a way to deal with it. And that we won't self-destruct, that instead we'll actually, you know, the best in humanity will prevail. And I hope that that's true.
I love it. No, definitely. I'm right there with you. You know, Maria, this was such a great chat. Before you go, I want to make sure that A, everybody knows that they can pick up the Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It, every time, wherever books are sold, it's everywhere. I'll even put a link in the show notes. But how can people, where are you most active on social media? How can people say, hey, and that they loved the book and that they, you know, that they heard you on the show?
I'm probably most active on Twitter, where I'm M. Konnikova. But I also do have a public Facebook profile, so you can definitely come and say hi over there. It's just Maria Konnikova. Very easy.
Very cool. Guys, reach out to Maria and say hello. Thank you again so much. This was such a wonderful chat.
Thank you. I had a really lovely time.
Absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.